In May of 1955, Housekeeping Monthly allegedly published an article entitled "The Good Wife's Guide," detailing all the ways that a wife should act and how best she can be a partner to her husband and mother to her children. So all of you who currently are or hope to someday be a wife, listen up. Because this is apparently the road to wifely perfection. Number one, have dinner ready. Plan ahead, even the night before, to have a delicious meal ready on time for his return. This is a way of letting him know that you've been thinking about him and are concerned about his needs. Most men are hungry when they come home. Okay, don't start that because I will not get through this list if you start laughing already. Truly. Most men are hungry when they come home, and the prospect of a good meal, especially his favorite dish, is part of the warm welcome he needs and deserves. Prepare yourself. Take 15 minutes of rest so you'll be refreshed when he gets home. Touch up your makeup. Put a wee ribbon in your hair and be fresh looking. Thankfully, I've got that covered, yeah. Be a little gay and more interesting for him. His day might need a lift, and your duty is to provide it. Clear away the clutter. Make one last trip through the main part of the house just before your husband arrives. Gather up any books or toys or etc., and then run a dust cloth over all the tables. Prepare the children. Take a few minutes to wash their hands and faces, and if they're small, comb their hair, and if necessary, change their clothes. Children are little treasures, and he would like to see them playing the part, so minimize all noise. At the time of his arrival, eliminate the noise of the washer or the dryer, and for heaven's sake, don't be running the vacuum cleaner, and do try to encourage the children to be quiet. Be happy when you see him. I'm happy now, Jim. Greet him with a warm smile and show him how sincerely that you want to please him. You may have a dozen important things to tell him, but the moment of his arrival is not the time. Let him talk first. Remember, his topics of conversation are more important than yours. Yeah, do you have any idea how much trouble I'm having actually saying these things? And there's more! Make the evening his. Never complain if he comes home late or goes out to dinner or other places of entertainment and doesn't take you. Instead, try to understand his world of strain and pressure and his very real need to be at home and relax. Your goal as the good wife is to make sure that your husband comes home to a place of peace and order and tranquility. So don't greet him with complaints and problems. Don't complain if he's home late for dinner and even if he stays out all night. Make him comfortable. Have him lean back in a comfortable chair or have him lie down. Arrange his pillow for him and offer to take off his shoes. Don't ask him questions about his actions or question his judgment or his integrity. Remember, he is the master of the house and you have no right to question him. And finally, ladies, a good wife always knows her place. So now that the hairs on the back of my neck are standing straight up and my blood pressure has elevated ever so slightly, I can assure you and my wonderful husband that this is not the norm in my house, nor will it ever be. And gentlemen, may I suggest you do not go home and try this at home. Now, in all fairness, the authenticity of this original publication has been called into question, and rightly so. But I think we would agree at the very least that things were different in the 50s and 60s. And the role of women in the household was not exactly what we would now think of as equality. But things changed. Right? Things changed. Or did they? In the early 1990s, so this is not that long ago, and it was only 30-some years after this alleged publication, an 11-year-old was in class one day in her elementary school in California watching TV. The class was studying commercials. And a commercial for dish soap came on and caught her attention. The tagline for the commercial was, "Women all over America are fighting greasy pots and pans." And two boys in her class spoke up right away and said, "Well, yeah, that's where women belong, in the kitchen." She remembers feeling shocked and angry and hurt, and at the age of 11, recognized immediately that this was just not right, and immediately felt that something needed to be done. So she went home and she told her dad what had happened, and he encouraged her to write letters. So she did. At the age of 11, she wrote letters to the most powerful people she could think of. She rationalized that if she wanted someone to actually hear what she had to say, who else would you write to but the First Lady, who at the time was Hillary Clinton? And then she wrote a letter to the news anchor at the program that she watched on a daily basis, Linda Ellerbee. And to make sure she'd covered all of her bases, she wrote a letter to the then very well-known powerhouse attorney, Gloria Allred, who was famous for advocating for victims and the marginalized. And finally, she wrote a letter to the soap manufacturer. A few weeks went by, and she started receiving letters back, and she received one of encouragement from Hillary Clinton, and one from Linda Ellerbee, and one from Gloria Allred. The news program that she'd written to sent a crew to her home to cover the story. And about a month later, the soap company, Procter & Gamble, changed the commercial for Ivory Clear dish soap from "Women all over the world are fighting greasy pots and pans" to "People all over are fighting greasy pots and pans." At the tender age of 11, her one voice affected change. Her one voice meant we were one step closer to stopping the perpetuation of gender discrimination. At the age of 11, she knew something had to be done, and she stood up for equality. Now, that 11-year-old, some of you may already know, was Meghan Markle. Yes, that Meghan Markle, the young woman who some of us got up at 4:30 in the morning earlier this month to walk down the aisle to marry her prince and not only become Prince Harry's wife, but the Duchess of Sussex. But at the time she wrote those letters, she was 11. Nobody had a clue who Meghan Markle was or who she would become. Sitting in that California classroom in the early 90s, she was an angry, hurt 11-year-old who recognized that something about the system was wrong and it needed to change. And in that very moment, she wasn't sure what or how, but she knew she had to do something. Our scripture reading this morning is from one of the greatest and most well-known prophets of the Bible, Isaiah. Now, the prophets, and there were several, were both men and women of all different ages, drawn from every walk of life, who were given a special word from God to deliver to their generation. Many were called to minister as a prophet for life, like was Isaiah and Jeremiah. And others served only briefly. So once they fulfilled their specific mission, they went back to living a quote-unquote normal life. But whether it was long-term or short-term, each one was driven by the conviction that he or she had been commissioned by God to proclaim a message that was, in essence, the word of the Lord. Now, Isaiah lived and ministered in Judah. In the chapters leading up to this morning's reading, we learn that the situation in Judah had become somewhat grim. The people had forgotten and forsaken the Lord. Their worship was futile. They were living immoral lives. Corruption marked their leadership. And now there was a political crisis. The long-serving king who brought the only stability that existed had just died. In the year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah saw a vision of God. And this wasn't simply a vision of a faraway God. Isaiah's vision was intimate and close and powerful and frightening and disturbing. It was the kind of vision that probably most of us never had, have ever had, and in all likelihood, it's the kind of vision we likely never will. This vision, Isaiah's experience of God, led Isaiah to the profound awareness of his own sin and the sin of his community. "I'm doomed," he said. "Everything I say is sinful, and so are the words of everyone around me." And as soon as he utters that confession in the vision, one of the flying creatures touches his lips with a hot coal and cleanses him. Isaiah, in that moment, is made whole. He is healed by an act of grace from God. And it is in response to God's presence and grace when Isaiah hears the call, "Is there anyone I can send?" Or maybe words that are more familiar to you, "Whom shall I send?" Isaiah responds, "I'll go. Send me. Here I am, Lord. I'll go." God knew the answer and had already chosen Isaiah. But the question, "Whom shall I send?" provided Isaiah with the opportunity to volunteer, to go willingly. Our service is important, but so is our willingness. God won't force us to serve. When asked, when called, when nudged, it's up to us to volunteer. It's up to us to step up to the plate. Answering the call from God is our response to God's forgiveness and grace. Isaiah is not volunteering because he thinks he has the skills that God needs to use. He's not responding, volunteering because he thinks he has some spare time on his hands, or that he needs something else that looks good on his resume. In the moment he responds, Isaiah doesn't even know what he's being called to do or how long it's going to take him. Isaiah is laying his life before God, who encountered him and made his life whole. He is responding to God's forgiveness and grace. And when we are called, we are called to respond in the same way. Not because we think we may have the skills that God requires. Not because we think we have some spare time. Not because we need to add something else to our resume. We answer the call. We step up to the plate in response to God's forgiveness and grace. And sometimes, many times, we are called to comfort the afflicted. but not always. Sometimes we are called to afflict the comfortable, to challenge the status quo, to upset those unjust systems. In 2006, Tarana Burke founded the Me Too movement to help survivors of sexual violence, particularly the young women of color from low-wealth communities, to find pathways to healing. Using the idea of empowerment through empathy, the Me Too movement was ultimately created to ensure survivors know they are not alone in their journey. Awareness of that movement went viral last October when a famous actress encouraged women to use social media to heighten awareness and give people a sense of the magnitude of the problem of sexual assault and harassment in the workplace. The Me Too movement has built a community of survivors from all walks of life, from all over the world. By bringing vital conversations about sexual violence into the mainstream, they are helping to destigmatize survivors by highlighting the breadth and impact sexual violence has on thousands of women and helping those who need it to find entry points to healing. Ultimately, with survivors at the forefront of this movement, they are aiding the fight to end sexual violence, hoping to uplift radical community healing as a social justice issue and disrupt all systems that allow sexual violence to flourish. Whom shall I send? Here I am, Lord. I'll go. In 2007, two grade 12 students in Berwick, Nova Scotia, along with some of their friends, took a stand against the very real, very prominent problem of bullying. They organized a high school protest after hearing that a grade 9 student was bullied for wearing a pink shirt to school. The friends went to a local discount store, purchased 50 pink tank tops, sent out a message that night to their friends, and the next morning hauled the shirts to school. As they stood in the foyer handing them out to everyone that came through the doors, the bullied boy walked in. And when he realized what was happening, his face spoke volumes. A huge weight was lifted. He wasn't alone. The bullies backed down and were never heard from again. There is now a national and an international Wear Pink and Anti-Bullying Day to raise awareness and to help prevent it from happening. Whom shall I send? Here I am, Lord. I'll go. Black Lives Matter, Bell Let's Talk, movements that challenge the status quo and afflict the comfortable, asking us to face difficult issues like racism and discrimination and mental health. We are not all Isaiahs, and just as Isaiah didn't live to see all of God's promises fulfilled when he answered God's call, not even knowing what it was, we might not either. But in our responding, we can make a difference. We can get one step closer to that new heaven and that new earth. Will every call that we respond to result in an international movement? Will every call that we respond to be newsworthy? Maybe not. Probably not. But if God is calling, the response is worthy. Every time we pay a little bit more for fair trade products, we are challenging the status quo. We are afflicting the comfortable. We're putting people before profit. And good for you, St. James, for stepping up to the plate and saying, fair trade coffee or no coffee. Good for you. Every time we refuse to shop at the Walmarts of the world, every time we refuse to buy goods from the companies with multi-billion dollar profits who pay six and seven figure bonuses to top executives, but feel perfectly justified in cutting staff hours and benefits because the minimum wage went up, Every time we refuse to stand in the self-checkout line and refuse to help corporations further cut staff hours, we're challenging the status quo. We're afflicting the comfortable. And we are answering that ongoing call of justice for all of God's people. Whom shall I send? Here I am, Lord. I'll go. So when the call from God comes, whom shall I send? No matter how loud or quiet, no matter the hour, no matter how young you are or how old you feel, no matter how busy you think you are or how qualified you think you are, when that call comes, may each one of us respond as Isaiah did. Here I am, Lord. I'll go.